Welcome to Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast, the only recurring podcast dedicated to insurance careers, insurtech startups, and insurance current events. We are your hosts, Carly Burnham, Tony Canyas, and Nick Lamparelli. You can find all of our podcasts, show notes, and other great insurance-related content at insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Welcome to Profiles in Risk, the INS Nerds podcast. And today we are recording episode 11 with special guest John Kramer and our usual Nick Lamparelli. Carly is not here with us today. Nick, how are you doing today?
Good, Tony. Happy weekend.
Awesome. Awesome. John, how's it going today?
Very well. Thank you.
Awesome. So I'll take a minute kind of to introduce John. So John is a director of business development and customer success with Octo Telematics, who I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit during this podcast. I met John, I don't know, at this point, like 5 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, back when we were both at Nationwide. I was going through a finance leadership development program, and John used to run Nationwide's telematics program. So that's kind of his thing is telematics, and that's what we'll talk about a lot today. So John, first thing that I was wondering, you're not exactly the guy that I would expect to be running a technology program at looking at your LinkedIn. I mean, you're an impressive guy. I'm not saying that. Looking at your LinkedIn, you were an English major in college.
Yes, I was. In fact, it's funny. I always say that when I was an English major, I thought I was going to be a secondary ed teacher, like teaching like high school English. But it's amazing how your life changes, right? When I got out of college, I said I needed to make some quick money, and it's not on my LinkedIn profile, but I sold cars for 5 years, I guess it was.
Wow.
Which, okay. Yeah. And then my buddy from college gave me a call, and he said, "Dude, I know you're sick of selling cars, working weekends, 12-hour days, just always under the grind." And he said, "You might take a little bit of a pay cut." He's like, "But the cool part about it is they'll give you a company car, a laptop, health insurance, 401k, and you have your weekends off." And admittedly, my foray into insurance was one where I said, "You know what? Maybe I'll become an insurance agent." I've never met a poor insurance agent, so I was like, "Maybe I'll make it in, kind of go into a sales role." Then I joined in underwriting, and I found I just absolutely was fascinated by insurance. And here I am still doing it.
So your first insurance job was at Nationwide?
Yeah. Yeah. So I started at Nationwide and, was actually a field underwriter for them.
I gotta say, we talk a lot about the whole millennial thing and entry-level jobs in insurance. That's a heck of an entry-level job. Was it 2003 is what I'm seeing on LinkedIn, but around the right year?
Yeah, that's about right.
Holy wow, it sure has changed. Underwriters nowadays, like, you usually spend a few years in the company before you make it there. So that is a really awesome first job. So I can see that. I can see that the whole move to be an underwriter and how you fell in love with underwriting. That's, it's an awesome industry. How did you go from underwriting to running Nationwide's telematics program, which I think didn't exist before you?
Yeah. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because you're right. I had a very focused underwriting track. In fact, it was property underwriting. That's all I did. I had a chance. I moved out to staff office when I was asked to lead their underwriting departments, or at least the field underwriting department. And fortunately, and you know how this is, Tony. I know that we've talked about this in the past. You network with people, you get to know people. And as luck would have it, my former regional vice president for product became the vice president of Standard Auto. And he invited me to lunch, and he said, "Hey, what do you know about telematics?" And I said, "Well, I saw your presentation." I said, "It sounded pretty cool. It makes sense to me." And he said, I think you should probably take a look into, we have a role opening. And he said, I think you'd be good at it. My response was, I'm not an auto guy. I'm not a pricing guy. I mean, it's clearly going to be a stretch. But what he had said to me was, he said, this is a very brand new cutting edge, bleeding edge type of technology. And really a way that we're going to be revolutionizing the industry. And it wasn't necessarily that, oh yeah, John's the greatest insurance mind to, you know, come across Nationwide Insurance. It was more on the lines of, I'm a pretty passionate guy when I get behind something, and I can get people to do stuff, right? And get people on board, and I can sell the concept. And yeah, it's kind of how it happened. I mean, I interviewed for it, obviously, and everything went the way of the HR role and all that stuff. But yeah, it was very much a they were looking for a specific role or feature. You know?
So I'm curious.
Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah, so I'm trying to envision telematics at the very beginning, and how many hurdles you had to jump over. You know, so it's brand new technology. What was the thinking on how specifically you would use it? Would it be, were you thinking originally that it would be used to sort of audit drivers to keep track of the number of miles being driven? Or was there some kind of intention right from the start that we can use this for pricing? Like that we could build new programs with this. Like, give me the thought process of what you were thinking brand new into the role and how you were looking out 1 year, 5 year, and 10 years.
At a very conservative Midwestern company started by a bunch of farmers, right? What was interesting was I remember when the position had come up, and I had lunch, and I came home, and I actually talked with my wife, and I said, you know what? I said, there's this opportunity that's been presented to me, and I was like, it's so weird and quirky, and just kind of green. I was like, do I even really want to do this? And my thought was, to your point there, Nick, it was like, this is so odd and strange that, number one, if I make a go of it and it actually becomes something impressive, I'm gonna be a superstar, right? If I fail at it, people will probably be pretty forgiving and be like, he gave it a good shot, he ran a good program, whatever, right? But so really, in those early stages, it was kind of a fast follower type of thing. So if you think back to 2009, 2010, 2011, Progressive was doing usage-based insurance. They were doing what was called, MyRate, right? So Progressive had been doing it for several years. They started with Autograph, and I think that was back in around 1998. That was their first iteration of 2000. Of telematics, where customers were given a device, they would have to send the device back to Progressive, and then they would rate them on it, right? MyRate involved the same type of process, but then what happened was they actually started transmitting the data via cellular network, and then it transitioned over to, as we know it, a snapshot. So really, the initial thought of it was, well, let's find out what this data says, right? And then from there, maybe we can figure out how we can use it, because the thought process, or at least conceptually, the idea was, you know what, we could use it for underwriting, right? We could segment out the worst customers and send them elsewhere or underwrite them out of the book of business, because, you know, clearly the auto industry, or even the entire P&C industry, really has been having some challenges with underwriting profitability in recent years, but also back then too. Or from a perspective of just pure price play, the data, we'll be able to take our drivers, we'll be able to segment them, and then just add it to the class plan and make them a more, you know, use it as an opportunity to segment, you know, best drivers from worst drivers, and then rate them accordingly. So it was kind of like, we'll figure out what we're going to do here, but let's start collecting data. Let's start getting it in. Let's start learning from the customers, from the agents, because, you know, as you guys know, taking and creating an insurance product, there's a lot of moving parts, right? So we really just kind of were like, let's find out what we don't know and learn from that.
So a lot of
back in 98,
a lot of ready, fire, aim.
I wouldn't say that it was ready, fire, aim. I mean, because directionally, like we said, we kind of had a template with what Progressive was doing. Hartford was doing something at that time as well. I think they had just released their TrueLane product at that time. So we were just following right in their steps. There was filings out there that we could use. It wasn't necessarily that we were just kind of going in blind. We had a bit of a template that we used. But our idea was, let's look at the data. Let's learn from the data. Let's figure out what we can do. And who knows, maybe we can, you know, instead of being a follower, maybe we could lead this trend.
But back in 1998, you got me thinking. Back in 1998, I was, I don't know, in like 9th, 10th grade. So kind of amazing that some version of this already existed. I'm kind of imagining like something like the Flintstones. And you know how they had animals doing all the chores and stuff, all the appliances. So I'm imagining like a pigeon holding on through the car, keeping track, and then flying back to the home office at the end of the day to report. So the technology, has it changed a lot in the time that you've been very involved in telematics since 2010 to now?
Yeah, well, so the thing is though, we didn't have the bird to fly it back. We actually had to have them send it back. But no, actually the technology since 2010 has evolved, okay? So early on the idea was, if we connect the vehicle, right, through the OBD2 port, which for people who don't know, it's your diagnostic port, your onboard diagnostic port that's in your vehicle. So if you get that mysterious check engine light in your car, you know, your mechanic will plug a tool in there to kind of say, all right, what's the deal here? What's going on here? And it gives some codes and data to tell them what's wrong, right? But the OBD2 port also has a lot of very granular data as far as like vehicle speed sensor that you can collect on a second by second basis. So the early on stages was, let's get the data connected from the connected car. Now we've actually started to see the proliferation, obviously, of smartphones, right? So using the smartphone as a sensor, quite candidly, the data is not nearly as robust, but from a customer acceptance perspective, it's a lot easier to download an app than it is to simply, you know, install a device or something. There's also some hybrid solutions, like a Bluetooth solution, where it's, you know, like a little thing that goes into the OBD2 port, but the mobile phone will act as the data transmission, or the GPS can be collected from that. And then there's also an OEM play. the auto manufacturers are actually starting to understand the value of the data that they're collecting with their embedded telematics data. So it's come quite a bit. It's come a really, really far way from those early stages.
Do you think we're moving? Go ahead.
So how expensive were the initial devices?
Oh my gosh, the first device that we installed in our car was like $150. They were, you know, and you guys know, if you have a standard auto product, a private passenger auto product, there's no way you can take $150 for a device, and then the data transmission costs on top of that, you know, the logistics, the shipping, just all of that stuff dialed in there. That isn't sustainable. The costs have come down considerably since then. You know, I mean, you can take a look out there. They're under $100 now. In fact, with great volumes, you can get them for pretty darn cheap.
Do you foresee as the auto manufacturers start adding them, do you think they will get to the point where it'll become a mandatory safety feature like a seatbelt, where just the government will say you should have it in every car after 2022 or something?
What's that? I'm sorry. As far as you mean, like a connected vehicle and?
Yeah. So. I think it would just make a lot of sense to just have it already installed in every vehicle, and that way the manufacturer can diagnose the car and accidents can be reported what was the GM one that's been around forever, that if you have an accident, it automatically reports it. OnStar, exactly. Like, it would just make so much sense to as a matter of safety, build that into every car.
Yeah, and actually, Tony, I think that's going to be the goal state. That is clearly going to be the goal state, because, you know, we're starting to see that the connected vehicle in and of itself is really starting to proliferate. So I just purchased a new car, and it has a fully connected telematics system that if I, you know, God forbid, smack into a tree somewhere, my manufacturer can actually contact me, kind of like an OnStar program. So, you know, like Mercedes has Embrace. It was one of the first ones. OnStar, Ford has the Sync connected vehicle, and there's a ton of them. that's going to be the goal state. However, if we look at the car park that's out there right now, there's what, about 220 million vehicles on the road in the United States, plus or minus. You know, and those vehicles, I mean, for all intents and purposes, are driving around with 20-year-old technology, right? So if the government said tomorrow every car is going to be connected and this type of like e-call service for safety and security was mandated, it would probably take us about 15 to 20 years to get through the car park. Yeah. And if you look at how long people are holding their cars now, the average age of the vehicle on the road today is what, 13 and a half years? So the horizon for that to happen and to be truly ubiquitous, it's going to be a bit. Yeah. But it's going to happen. It's just a matter of when. Yeah.
So, the career thing was really interesting, the transition. And we always like to kind of look at how people's careers developed in the industry to give other people an idea of how to do it. So what was it like? So you're at Nationwide, you're running this program. It's starting to really get going. I think you rolled it out from pilot to 8 states is what I remember reading.
That's right.
So what did you get? Like, did you meet the Octo people through that job, and they're like, "Hey, we'd really love to have you." How did that transition happen, and what was it like going to a technology supplier after being at a carrier for several years?
So I felt like Luke Skywalker with the concept of going to the dark side, and I say that very tongue in cheek, but I mean, you know how it is. I mean, we work with providers, you know, in the insurance industry, we work with providers. You know, they provide a lot. There's a lot of service providers out there doing different things. I mean, from data transmission, reconstruction cost estimation, claims reports. There's a million and one different types of providers out there. Going to the telematics space was actually a pretty easy transition for me, because the key thing is, and you guys kind of hinted at it before, I'm not a technology guy. I'm not. I'm an insurance guy. I love insurance. I love the industry. In fact, I was at RIMS this past week, and I was talking to some actuarial students, and I just kept telling them how awesome the industry is. So I made it very clear when I went into my new position, I'm not the sales guy. I'm not the technology guy. You want to talk TCOM? I don't want to do that. I want to talk about how we can use sensors to make insurance products and services. That was my goal. So really coming into it, and with the knowledge I had in running the program at Nationwide and doing the pilot and even knowing the industry and the people who were in the industry, it was a relatively easy transition. I think the bigger transition or the bigger challenge for me was going from a large, you know, Fortune 100 company with 33,000 associates to a company that now has about 350 associates worldwide. So that was some change management there. But it was the challenge, I would say. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Octo. I've never seen a commercial for them. I've never had somebody mention their Octo device in the car. So where does Octo fit into the whole telematics and insurance world?
Yeah. So Octo Telematics was the first official telematics service provider out there. Founded in 2002 in Rome, Italy, right? And what we did was, it was actually started by our CEO. His name is Fabio Spianchi. Essentially what happened was he got his renewal for his car insurance, and he said, what the heck's going on here? I'm paying for all this premium for a vehicle that's sitting in the garage, you know, 6-7 months out of the year. And he said that he wanted to create a way that people could actually pay for the insurance that they actually use the way that it's assumed it's being used, right? So the company, actually, Octo started, as I said, in 2002, but it's ballooned to be the largest telematics service provider in the world. We've got 39% global market share for usage-based insurance. I mean, we're working with, we have 90 partners, 60 insurance companies, and just here in North America, we've got 4 of the top 12 private passenger auto providers in the United States. We've got the largest insurance company in Canada. And, you know, we've got, I think, 17 or 18 programs in both personal lines and commercial lines just here in the United States. In fact, in the United States, we've shipped over, I want to say it's 2.5 or close to 3 million devices just here in the U.S.
Wow.
The devices don't say Octo, right? I remember we had a conversation that the one I have in my car is probably one of yours, but it's branded by the insurance company.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, so being a household name, yes, we've got millions of vehicles connected, but ultimately I don't see us being a household name because primarily we're working directly with insurance companies. You know, it's kind of like LexisNexis or Willis Towers Watson or, you know, somebody like that, CCC, for example. That's a company that obviously insurance people would know, but not necessarily that a consumer would know. You know, our products are basically white labeled for the insurance industry so that they can go out and make it their own thing. It's, you know, it's Nationwide Smart Ride or Liberty Mutual Right Track or, you know, any number of companies. You know, that's how we do it.
So John, as you can see from my last name, I have a long vowel. I'm immensely curious as to why are the Italians leading in this space? What happened there that didn't happen elsewhere?
Yeah, you know what? It's funny because we asked ourselves that quite a bit here in the United States, because when we started this, we knew that Italy was way ahead of the curve, right? And now working for an Italian company, I have a lot of indications and some insight into this. The one thing was there were some stolen vehicle issues, right? So connecting a vehicle with GPS data, you can actually recover a stolen vehicle, right? So that's one thing. The other thing is, too, there's something that happened in Europe called eCall, which is basically like a, I guess you could say, a national version of OnStar, right? So that if a vehicle has an accident, that crash and claims data can go for emergency responders and such. So clearly the insurance companies then have capitalized upon this and have really taken hold of this, understanding I've got a connected vehicle, I've got these sensors, you know, and now, you know, we're starting to see that the proliferation of these programs are just, they're going crazy over in Europe. You know, they've got a ton of market share in this space, but that was pretty much the catalyst for it.
Yeah, but it sounds like that would be something very difficult to happen here because we don't have that national agenda to do what the Italians did. So it's really got to be built up the way that you're building it from the ground up.
Precisely. And in fact, it's funny too, because we talk about the groundswell of activity that we've seen in Europe. We're actually starting to see that here in the United States as well. In fact, as we were talking prior to the actual webcast here, you know, 10 or not, excuse me, 9 of the top 10 private passenger auto companies have telematics programs right now. Okay. And I think what the top 10 are, I think somewhere in around the 75% to 80% of the entire private passenger auto market. Right. But there is a little bit of challenge. Obviously, we have 51 jurisdictions here in the United States, including D.C., and each one of those filing rules are a little bit different. You know, for example, in California, we know about Prop 103, which will only allow certain data elements to be used for rating. So telematics, usage-based insurance, as we know it, can't be done. And California is, what, 20% of the entire U.S. population. But that said, we're actually putting the industry at somewhere just under 10% of all private passenger auto is attributed to usage-based insurance at this point.
I spent a couple of years out in California, first as an Allied sales manager, and then as an American Modern sales manager. And I think that most of our listeners probably have never worked California insurance. So I think it's worth to explain that so in California, the things that you are not allowed to use are basically everything that's predictive. everything that you want to use to actuarially rate auto, the only thing you're allowed to use is number of miles driven. And the problem is, it's very easy in a pre-telematics world to lie about how many miles you drive. So rating auto in California without telematics is so hard. And that's a perfect transition, by the way, to Metromile. I was wondering on your thoughts on Metromile and then, you know, Root, both of which I'm sure you're familiar, but both for any listeners that are not. So Metromile is a San Francisco based, they sell themselves as auto insurance when you need it for the urban population, doesn't use their car much. And then Root, which is Ohio based, another Nationwide alumni, we're all over the place.
Nationwide.
Exactly. He went to FLRP with me, Alex Tim. So anyway, Roots, which opened, I think, last year, maybe early last year, which is also telematics-only option. So what do you think of those telematics-only personal auto companies?
So if you think about what a large insurance company wants to do, they want to appeal to as broad of a market as possible that can fit into their underwriting, you know, into their underwriting guidelines, right? Whereas if you add telematics into that mix, you are automatically going to, and I don't want to say alienate, but you're automatically going to exclude a certain part of the population, because no matter how much discount or how much benefit you're going to give to somebody, some people are not going to install a device in their car and give that data to an insurance company or to anybody. Okay. I mean, I don't care. I'm thinking of my brother, for example. He's a guy who disconnected his OnStar because he was afraid they were monitoring him and tracking him. Right. Anyway, my thought on it though is, I absolutely love it because it's disruptive. Right. And I think, as a person who has done telematics, as a person who used telematics, and actually as a person who has earned discounts on his insurance policy for telematics, I think it's an absolutely spectacular way of doing business. For example, I travel a lot, right? My vehicle's sitting either in my garage or in an airport. So I'm paying, you know, X number of dollars per year, but my mileage is very, very low. So being able to pay for that, at the rate that I'm, actually using, or the way that I'm actually, my experiences, that's fantastic. And I think it's great. I think you're also going to start to see, though, that, you know, the type of person who's going to go into this program, and Tony, you said it perfectly, you know, people who live in urban environments, who maybe only drive their car to the grocery store on the weekends, because, hey, I can commute to work, taking mass transit. You're going to find people maybe who are just comfortable with technology. They're going to be like, oh, you know what? This is a cool way of doing insurance. It makes sense. And I think it's going to be quite disruptive. And I think, as we see it proliferate, Metro Mile is a great example. I forget how many states they're in, but they're really, really expanding. And larger insurance companies are starting to scratch their head and say, how's this going to impact me? And I think it's going to, even though I have a telematics product, it's a me too type of thing. Whereas these guys are going right at it and saying, look, this is connected vehicles. We're going to be able to rate you how you want to be done, and it's pretty awesome.
Well, if you're people who drive very little, start leaving and going to Root and Metro Mile and other really cheap options that where they really pay for their risk. You know, it's adverse selection. Your rate's going to increase for the rest of your customers. So yeah, it's a tricky thing if you're a Nationwide or a State Farm or a big carrier.
Yeah, well, and statistics have shown, the data has shown, that people who adopt telematics programs, number one, are less risky, just inherent. Two, we've also found that, people with coaching and behavioral type of training, I think it was somewhere around a third of customers said that they've changed their driving habits significantly based upon that data. So you're actually affecting the profitability of your organization. Plus, we also know that, customers who are in telematics programs, they retain a heck of a lot better too. So you're getting safer drivers who are retaining for longer. I mean, who wouldn't want that?
Yeah. So John, what can a telematics device provide? Well, you had mentioned changing driving habits. Perhaps you can give our audience a flavor of all the different things that some of these, that these devices can do to lower claims costs.
Yeah. So in addition to, so most telematics, I'm just going to talk about dongle devices, right?
Yeah.
The ones that are being used for the larger insurance companies, right? These types of technologies have a lot of data. For example, they have GPS data, they have accelerometer data, they have all of the vehicle sensors that are coming off of the OBD2. So, from a crash and claims perspective, and actually, and I don't mean to plug my company, but I'm going to, because this is something that we do extremely well. From a crash and claims perspective, algorithms can be developed that can predict within a very, very accurate way whether or not a vehicle has had an accident when a telematics device is present. In fact, our algorithm is 94% accurate, as determined by the Ohio State University Center for Automotive Research and Engineering. Go Buckeyes. Sorry, I lived in Columbus for too long. I had to do it. But that said, it's one of these things then. Now, if you think about this, the algorithm basically will collect the data. It will determine that there was an accident. And within 90 seconds, that's our latency, we can send that information to the insurance company. Think about it from that perspective. You can start a claim within 90 seconds of after an accident happening, right? You can arrange for a rental car. You can, send a tow truck or an emergency responder if need be, kind of that e-call thing that we're talking about that they have over in Europe. And rather than the insurance, or excuse me, rather than the automaker doing this, it's the insurance company, right? So that's one thing that this provides. The technology also provides some real tangible data for the user about fuel efficiency. So being able to say, hey, you can save a couple of bucks if you drive less aggressively or whatnot. And also just vehicle health in and of itself. That mysterious check engine light that pops on, it's able to say, hey, this is an O2 code, and your O2 sensor is messed up. You're going to need to get that fixed. So it's more than just the simple insurance stuff. It's also some value to the to the insured as well.
Mine, so I've got one in my car, and I got it for the discount, and I got a 9% discount. Mysteriously, it went from 10 to 9% just before the discount was settled after 90 days. But I love that they let me keep it. The app for it is very useful, and it really kind of gamified. It has a couple of things I really like. One of them, it beeps when I hit 73 miles an hour or if I brake hard, and it trains you basically. It trains you to drive differently so that it won't beep as often. And I've had it for probably a year now, and definitely noticed the difference with how now it almost never beeps at me. So it definitely changed my driving. So that's fantastic. And I also love that the nerd in me loves being able to open the app or open the website and be able to see all of my driving. And it's very interesting. Very, very interesting. I'm a big fan of quantifying my life. So overall, I just think it's a lot of fun. Now, we talked earlier about how it took off in Italy, and we talked also about how people like your brother will just never get on board. I wonder, as a foreigner, I wonder if it's a cultural difference. Americans, from my opinion, tend to be a little more prickly about our privacy issues than at least us Latinos outside of the States. And I wonder if Europeans are also less concerned about privacy than Americans are. I wonder if that's one of the reasons that it's taken longer here to take off. Have you seen that?
Yeah,
trying to sell the idea here in the States.
Yeah, actually, I was going to say that there's a certain segment of the population that, and as I had said, and people are pegging this at somewhere in around 20 to 25% that no matter what you do, they're not going to do it, right? But we have found that many of the objections for anybody else can be conquered by just simply being transparent and saying, hey, look, this is what we're using the data for. This is how it's going to benefit you. This is the worst that could happen to you. This is the best that can happen to you, right? I would say that from a cultural perspective, I can't really speak to that. Simply put, I'm the North American guy, so they don't let me out of the country, which is probably a good thing because I could do a lot of damage. But I would say that that's probably just thinking about it, from what I know, that I think is a pretty good read on it. Us Americans are wired differently, but I know that the listeners can't necessarily see this, but we all have cell phones too. These smartphones that we're carrying around are collecting a ton of great data that can be used for a lot of very good things. And I actually have seen, so when we started back at Nationwide, and if you look at Progressive and Allstate, they didn't use GPS data, right? We're actually starting to see a trend. So Allstate's using GPS data now. Progressive is using GPS data, and I'm sure that every other major insurer is going to start doing this, because I think that the proliferation of the smartphone has actually helped us in overcoming that objection, right? I mean, tag, I'm in Facebook, I'm going here, I'm doing this. So I actually think that that resistance to the data is starting to change people, most people, but there's always going to be those outliers.
So what are some of the lessons learned in auto that can be applied to telematics, or maybe not telematics, sensors for homes? Yes. You know, moving to the property side, you're starting to see Nest, Roost. There's a bunch of companies there, and they're probably at the same infancy stage that you experienced. What's your opinion of those sensors, and what do you think? Do you think they'll have a bigger struggle than auto? What are the challenges they may face?
So I will put it in terms that I understand. So having done auto and having done property, okay, if a car wrecks, an average car, okay, the average vehicle nowadays, I think, is $33,000. Okay, that's like the average, you know, if you just go average. The average home is considerably more, right? So if I know as a property insurer that a house that I can mitigate a house burning to the ground and having to pay out a large loss like that, it's going to take off. But to your point, Nick, I wouldn't even say that it's in its infancy. It's like, this is kind of like on day one, God said, let there be light. That's kind of where we're at right now with property. Insurance companies, though, are looking at Nest, and they're looking at, you know, the Amazon Tower and all those other sensors that are out there right now. And they're starting to say, you know what, there's value here, and I can really assess risk or mitigate risk by using these sensors and then providing insurance customers discounts for using this. And I know like Liberty Mutual is big on this. Nationwide had mentioned something about it. And there's a couple others that have come out publicly and said, you know, we're using home stuff. I think that the home stuff is going to be a longer tail, just because I think that, you know, with a vehicle, it's OBD2, it's one type of data. With the home space, there's going to be a lot of different type of data. Plus, it's your home. And there might be a little bit of resistance there. Just, I mean, my home is my sanctuary. Mm-hmm. I don't know how I feel about letting that camera feed come into my insurance company.
Yeah, and the sensors are expensive. To handle having a camera at your door, measuring water, you know, that could be thousands of dollars. So I've written about this a few times on the site, which is, who's going to pay for that? That's too much of an investment for an insurance company to just hand over. So now even though there's an alignment of interest to keep claims costs down, it's really up to the homeowner, the property owner, to install the sensors, and the insurance company to come in behind and say, if you do that, we'll give you some kind of discount. But now they don't have the data because the homeowner installed it.
That's right. And also, Nick, if you think about it from a perspective of, you know, homeowners insurance as a whole, I mean, you know, I think the average premium for private passenger auto nationally is like $1,200-$1,300. The average premium for a homeowner's insurance policy is what, like $600, if that maybe.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're talking about something, you know, $1,000 worth of technology or even $100 worth of technology for, you know, premium that's $600, $800, $700. The economics don't necessarily work. However, I think that the insurance companies, at least as I'm seeing it, and the way that I would have probably done it if I was a product manager in property, I would say, if you do this and you give me this data, one, inherent to having something like this, I'll just give you a discount, right? Because the idea being kind of like that angel effect, whereby, you know, by having something like this, number one, I'm probably going to be more risk averse to begin with as a person. Two, as a consumer, I'm still getting the benefit and all that. But three, I can get, you know, a little discount on my insurance. That's perfect. And I think that way, at least for an insurance company, to make it work economically, you know, hey, if you're going to do this, that's great. We're going to reward you a bit for it without having to incur the cost. So the proliferation, to your point, the proliferation is going to be a while until a low-cost solution has been created. Yeah.
Yeah, understood. So I had a couple of personal questions. So we have a lot of young listeners, And, you know, you've had a successful career both on the carrier side and now on the technology side. So from the perspective of giving advice to young people coming into insurance, what do you suggest? How does someone become successful in insurance?
So Tony has heard me say this before because I spoke at his ARG back at Nationwide. And I remember saying this one thing, and it's something that my first real boss told me, and it's like burnt into the brain. There's two things. The first thing being, you don't network. You build relationships, okay? You find these individuals who have influence or, you know, might be able to help you along in your career. And you don't network with them and just connect with them on LinkedIn. You build a relationship with them. You get them to know your name and just show that curiosity and that desire. I think, you know, people who've been around the block for a couple of years appreciate that. And admittedly, I mean, I've been doing insurance now for about 15 years in some form or another. It's exciting for me to see somebody who's got that zest. And it kind of gives me a little kick in the butt. Say, you know what, look at this. They're looking at this fresh. They're really excited. That's pretty awesome. So build those relationships. The other thing is, I am a big fan of mentors. Find somebody that you can trust, somebody that will be able to help you, that will be honest with you and say, you know what, you need to work on this, or, you know, you're doing a great job with that. And I say find a mentor. It doesn't necessarily mean just go out and get a mentor and you're good. I've had three professional mentors in my life that were very formal things. In fact, the one guy I sent packing because I wasn't getting anything out of it. He was kind of like he was doing it, I guess, maybe as part of his development plan at work or something. I wasn't getting a benefit from it. But, you know, find somebody in the industry that will work with you and will invest in you to really grow you. And Tony will smile very large when I say this too. Also, continuing education, do the CPCU route. I'm serious. And I'll tell you, one of my biggest regrets having left Nationwide was I took a couple of the CPCU courses and I never finished my CPCU. And it's killing me because, you know, a lot of insurance companies will provide you, they'll pay you to do it. I mean, it's free and you get to go to cool exotic trip to like Hawaii or something.
So San Diego next year. So or you won't make it in time for Orlando, but you have a lot of plane time while you're flying to meetings. You should bring the books with you and aim for San Diego. It'll be a blast.
Okay.
Well, I'll tell you. Yeah. Our company is based our West Coast operation is based in San Diego. So I will tell you any chance I get to go to San Diego, I'm going to San Diego. I love it. So
there you go. Year after that, it's New Orleans. So either of them are going to be just a ton of fun. It really pays. It really helps you break out of the early levels. And it's kind of amazing that how good or how lucky or both you were on your career at the beginning. For those of us who came in later, especially after the 2009 recession, it's so much harder to grow. Getting your CPCU is one of the ways that you can really stack your chances to get that early growth in your career. It really pays off.
Yeah, there is one other thing that I've forgotten, and I think, and you guys have probably figured this out about me. The other thing is, and this is absolutely critical, and I don't care where you are in life, if you're coming into the business or if you're, you know, 40 years in, you got to find your passion and you've got to go for it. You know, in fact, you were asking me how the heck did you get on the carrier from a carrier to a technology thing? I actually was going to go work for Nationwide. So what happened was the reason I left Nationwide was because I moved. My wife is a college professor. And she got a tenure track position. And I moved to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And there's a huge office here in Harrisburg. And I was going to go work in the Harrisburg regional office. And everything was set. I was ready to go. But there was this little piece of me that felt like it was going to die giving up telematics. I couldn't let it go. It was like we were like right on the cusp of this. And I'm like, I can't let it go. So that's kind of how I got into the telematics space after that. So there, the truth has come out. It was nothing. nothing controversial or scary, but that's what happened.
Yeah, I wrote an article about that right before New Year's. Remember, Tony? You can't follow your passion because you don't know what your passion is, but you can find your passion. Like you, John, found it. You went in one particular direction and something bit you and it just overwhelmed. You developed an expertise and a knowledge set where it enveloped everything you did and you were willing to give up a lot to keep moving in that particular direction. So that is fantastic advice, I think, for our audience. And I'm curious, when you're hiring people, what do you look for?
So I look for that passion. I do. I will tell you, I've hired, since I've been working at Octo, our team has grown immensely. And I've hired three or four people, okay? And the one thing I look for is that spark and that fire in their belly for what it is they're looking to do, right? It's one thing to say, oh, yeah, I want a job and I want a career and I want to do this. Everybody wants that, right? I mean, you know, we all have our goals. But it's one thing to get the career goal. It's to see that fire and that spark. That's something, when I interview somebody, you either have it or you don't. And when I see that person has it, I'm like, this is the person. This is the one I need to get. And fortunately, that intuition and that passion that I look for, it's paid off. I mean, the second to last person I hired has become like this amazing, she's just become a real subject matter expert. And when we're talking about telematics, I just saw her eyes get huge and just get excited and ask all the questions. And so, yeah, look for that passion. I do it all the time.
Yeah, there's no better feeling than when you hire someone and they become something. Like that is just a magical feeling.
Yeah. So as a dad, kind of have that dad mode.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's exactly what happened with me. I had some great mentors and great leaders who nurtured me and kind of pushed me along my way. And you know what? I need to pay that forward. In fact, my second boss at Nationwide said, I know I have succeeded when you can do my job. And I remember thinking, there's a lot of managers who wouldn't want you to know their job because there's a threat there, right? But if you actually, you know, are doing a good job and mentoring somebody, that means that you're nurturing them, you're helping them, and I've freed myself up for the next thing.
Well, that's the advice I've received a couple of times. You know, if you're an executive, you can't go to the next level until your boss knows that someone can replace you, that someone can do your work. So it's actually in your best interest as a boss to make sure that the people behind you can actually do your work, because that's the only way you're going to be able to escape that position.
Yeah.
So
unfortunately, though, there are people out there who don't necessarily subscribe to that. My other advice is find those people and get the heck away from them as fast as you can.
Good advice.
Tony laughing.
It's been a really good conversation. We always try to close on a positive personal note, usually with the question, what are you proud about this week, or what are you happy about this week? So John, being the guest, normally we start with Carly, girls first, but ladies first. Since you're the guest this week, we'll although you look a little bit confused on the camera, so I can start with Nick. Nick, what are you proud about this week, or what are you happy about this week?
Well, it was a very busy week, so I'm happy that I was actually able to get through it. I have some big news to announce probably in the next week or two. So I can't explicitly come out and say what I need to say, but I'd like to keep the audience on the edge of their toes on this. So big news coming in 2 weeks.
Awesome. John, what are you happy about this week? What are you proud about this week?
All right. So I'm happy and I'm proud. So I'm happy that my Celtics beat Washington today. Yeah, Nick. Excellent.
Yes.
I was so worried about that because they were behind. But the Celtics pulled it out, and obviously we were down two games, and we beat our friends there in Chicago. So I'm happy about that. What I'm proud about, actually, is I am proud of my kids. So both of my children run track, and I was at their track meet earlier today, which explains why my head looks burnt. And they both did a fantastic job. My son finished second in one of his heats, and my daughter finished second in one of hers. So, and it was a huge track meet too. So I'm pretty proud of them. So if that's okay, I'm proud of them, awesome. Not necessarily. Yeah.
You got your priorities straight.
That is very cool. Very, very, very cool. So I'll go last. So I've got two also. I'm very proud about the just ridiculous growth that INS Nerds has had this last week or two. So Carly and I went to the CPC Society Leadership Summit, and we advertised it a lot there. Then I spoke at NAMIC, and I advertised it a bunch there. And I mean, we have been seeing just ridiculous growth. I mean, we're talking 30 to 50 people a day worth of growth in overall distribution, which at this point we're at like 80, 250 almost people in the industry that we reach. So that just makes me happy. And to go with that, we are finishing up, there's still a few hours left in the week, but we're finishing up both a record week and a record month in terms of number of visits. So we worked hard to make it happen, and I'm very, very proud to see it happen. So anyway, it's growing. I call it the Nick Lamparelli effect, because the chart's really funny. It was flat or like flattish, and pretty much right when we brought Nick, it just took off. So whatever he does, I don't know. And then I'll nerd out a little here in the last couple of minutes. I am very happy that I've been wanting an Oculus Rift for a while. I don't know if you guys are familiar. It's the virtual reality headset that you can plug into your computer. I had read that technology has really advanced from when I tried it about 10 years ago. I tried it at the mall a couple of weeks ago when my mom was here, and I was blown away. I tried the climbing game and looked down and was basically sick for the rest of the evening. It was crazy how ridiculous it is. So anyway, so I finally bought one just yesterday, and I've been playing with it, and I have to say, it is mind-blowingly amazing. Simply, I never expected it to be that mind-blowingly amazing. It's like being in the Matrix. So article coming about, I'm trying to rock my brain on how virtual reality and artificial reality, no, excuse me, virtual reality, augmented reality, and modified reality, VR, AR, and MR, how the article coming on how we're predicting they will affect insurance and risk management, because this has to have a million uses as it takes off. It is truly just mind-blowingly amazing. So anyway, I'll probably post some YouTube videos or something of me looking really silly in the middle of the living room playing with my Oculus Rift. So anyway, I'm just a happy camper right now. So anybody has any closing comments? I have
to say about the augmented reality, virtual reality thing. So thinking about it from an insurance perspective, there's a company, a small mutual company based out of Texas, and I forget the name of them, but I will send it to you. Okay.
Awesome.
Cause it's off on Strategy Meets Action. They gave them an award. We won the award for telematics stuff. This company won it, where they were teaching their risk managers and loss control managers, like the little box, right? So instead of taking a test about, you know, yeah, something here, you know, yeah, what do you do? And you hit the ABC. It was literally a virtual reality simulation, so that when they turned their head, it was like, oh, there's a ditch here with an electric line. You know, we don't want to do this. So it was really, really cool. And when they were talking about it, I got kind of geeked out, and I asked him, I said, can I try it? And he said, oh yeah, sure. And oh my gosh, Tony, it was amazing. It was the coolest thing ever. And I'm like, wow, taking loss control to a totally different level. Instead of this paper learning, it's situational and applicable. So I will send it to you for your article.
I can only imagine, because it truly is mind-blowing, it truly is mind-blowing. Nick, any closing comments before we close for the week?
No, telematics is huge. Sensors are huge. John, we'd like to have you back on the show at some point for an update, to see how you're doing and how the industry's doing. So I'm very appreciative. Thank you for coming on the show.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure.
Thank you to our listeners for joining us on Profiles in Risk, Episode 11. Please take the time, go to iTunes and leave us a review, preferably a good one. That helps other people find us, and tell all your friends about Profiles in Risk and INS Nerds. We are here to enlighten you, entertain you, and guide you as you grow in the insurance industry. Thank you so much.
Bye, everyone.